The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated March 25, 2025. The front cover is, as usual, bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large capital block lettering. It's in a very dark gray superimposed upon black, so it's actually rather hard to see if they're trying to superimpose themselves upon their reading public. A person dressed in white, a man with balding, or I should say receding hairline, dark hair, dark eyes, dark facial hair, earrings, looking toward the lens of the camera. He's wearing a double-breasted white suit with no collar, no lapel, apparently no shirt underneath except a jewelry item, which is a choker. He's wearing jewelry on his hands as well, and black shoes. Behind him, in a rearing position, is a black horse. The caption reads, "Horsepower, now at Ferrari, Lewis Hamilton races to claim his place as F1's greatest." That is F as in Frank. F1's greatest. I'm beginning today with what Time calls the light box. It's a double spread photograph. Ramadan in Rafah, R-A-F-A-H. These two pages feature, it might as well be in black and white, but it's not. It's in color because I can see either a sunset or a muted sunrise on the horizon in the background. It is apparently a city street. It is apparently taken from an aerial view, and it's just rubble. There's a concrete everywhere. Some of it still appears as walls of buildings. Most of it is just chunks and pieces, just a lot of gray and smashed up looking stuff. There are people moving along the street, which is more or less centered in this two-page photograph. There are people mostly dressed in dark colors, moving in both directions, but in the very center of this street are long, long tables. I'm going to guess half a mile to a mile of tables, end to end to end to end, with blue plastic-looking chairs, each occupied by a person. The caption reads, "Palestinians gather for a community iftar dinner to break their fast the first day of Ramadan in Rafah, Gaza, March 1. The next day, Israel blocked all food and aid into Gaza, a move that mediators in Egypt and Qatar, as well as the UN and other aid providers, called a violation of international humanitarian law." So this is Ramadan in the rubble. It is obviously then a muted sunset that I am seeing in the background of this photograph. The photograph is credited to Ali Jadala Anadolu, Getty Images. The brief, setting the pace. A photograph here, a full page photograph in color. President Trump in the foreground looking, I don't know if he's looking serious or sincere or smug or what, but he's wearing a dark blue suit, white shirt, red and blue tie. Behind him are Speaker of the House, is it Jackson or Johnson? I'm sorry, I don't know. And Vice President Vance. Behind them hanging from the what appears to be the ceiling to the floor, a U.S. flag. This is the brief opener by Philip Elliott. Donald Trump paused long enough for a campaign stop on Capitol Hill. Perhaps the clearest distillation of President Donald Trump's sprawling first address to the new Congress came when he brought up Social Security. Politicians usually mention the program to assure Americans they will protect it or to claim the other party will not. Trump proceeded to lay out the premise for cutting it. Over 130,000 people, according to the Social Security databases, are aged over 160 years old, Trump asserted. He added 1,041 of these people are over the age of 220. The figures he quoted had been thoroughly debunked, with even his own Social Security chief executive explaining the numbers are a misreading of an ancient federal database. In other words, there's no proof any of those people are getting monthly checks. But the facts were not the point. The night of March 4 was entirely about feelings, and if everything about the evening felt overwhelming, that's because it was, and by design. For the 6 weeks leading up to Trump's speech, Washington had been yanked and ghosted, lurched and savaged, all with a merciless urgency. Swift and unrelenting action was how Trump described his record. It was one of the few uncontestable statements from the dais. Republicans were all too happy to stand and applaud on command as Trump leaned comfortably on the podium, promoting debunked theories about autism, predicting the U.S. would get Greenland one way or another. One of their loudest cheers was for Elon Musk, the billionaire bad boy trying to break Washington as head of DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency. Their celebration was more restrained, however, when the president talked about his trade war, which had erased all the gains Wall Street posted since Trump won in November. Tariffs are about making America rich again and making America great again, and it's happening, and it will happen rather quickly. There may be a little disturbance, but we're okay with that. It won't be much, Trump promised. Economists, stock traders, grocers have all warned that levying tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China so far will certainly raise prices for consumers. Republicans who won office by campaigning against inflation have not dared confront Trump on this, and the GOP House leadership said it's a problem best ignored, advising members to just stop holding town halls where angry constituents could confront their representatives. Meanwhile, policy caroms on. The day after Trump's speech, the White House announced a 30-day pause on tariffs on the auto sector. The day after that, all tariffs on Mexico and Canada were postponed. Democrats in Congress have watched with confusion, fear, and outrage as Trump has dismissed tens of thousands of federal workers, shut down offices that feed the world's poor, and track weather systems, and along the way discarded a global order the U.S. both made and led. When Representative Al Green of Texas, a Democratic lawmaker who is often a step afield from his party, stood alone in the chamber to protest as Trump delivered his address, House Speaker Mike Johnson ordered him removed by the security staff. Democrats stayed in their seats, holding signs declaring Musk steals, a tepid attempt at expressing disapproval. But within the first half hour of a record-breaking 100-minute speech, Democrats were streaming out of the chamber, disgusted at Trump's constant blaming of former President Joe Biden from everything from immigration to egg prices. The president was put out. This is my fifth such speech to Congress, and once again, I look at the Democrats in front of me, and I realize there's absolutely nothing I can say to make them happy or make them stand or smile or applaud. Nothing I can do, he complained. Outside the Capitol, the implications of deep cuts to government appear to be starting to become more clear to voters. Trump's culture war spats over transgender rights and wokeness. He made himself chairman of the Kennedy Center, Hollywood's foothold in the Capitol, are unlikely to offset the economic consequences of an unpredictable trade policy. Trump's feud with Ukraine's leaders to a position the Kremlin declared largely aligns with our vision has U.S. policy out of step with not just GOP hawks, but also huge portions of the American public. Polls suggest his grievance-driven agenda may be starting to feel to many like a reality show that has stretched on a few seasons too long, and it hasn't been 2 months. We have accomplished more in 43 days than most administrations accomplish in 4 years or 8 years, and we are just getting started, Trump said. He may be correct. More than 400 executive actions are on the books, and he's closing in on 100 executive orders. And if much of it may not track with what he is selling, the details are less relevant than the chaotic flurry of activity. Trump is completely aware that he is Washington's pace car. Honora's Big Night. This is a photograph approximately a third of the page, maybe closer to half. It's in full color. Everyone on the photo is in formal attire, women in strapless or barely strapped gowns, men in tuxedos, one man holding a small statue. Sean Baker, director of Honora, a dramedy about a young sex worker from Brooklyn's Brighton Beach neighborhood, accepts the Oscar for Best Picture at the 97th Annual Academy Awards in Hollywood, March 2. The $6 million film won 5 Oscars, including Best Actress for Mikey Madison. This is an actress in pink. Baker's 4, including editing, original screenplay, and directing, set a record. The Bulletin by Chad de Guzman. After Ukraine, Taiwan ambiguity stirs anxiety. Donald Trump chooses his words carefully when it comes to Taiwan. I never comment on that, the president said at the White House February 26, after being asked if the U.S. would ever allow China to forcefully take control of the self-governing island it claims as its own. I don't want to ever put myself in that position, he said. Ambiguity. Avoiding clarity is not a new approach. The U.S. has long observed a policy of strategic ambiguity on Taiwan. But observers say there are other clues as to how the Trump administration may deal with Taiwan. Recent dealings with Ukraine, for example, reflect a transactional approach to foreign policy and conflict resolution. Taiwan President William Lai-ching Tay said his government is willing to cooperate with the U.S. in every respect and has promised to increase its own defense spending to 3% of its GDP. Trump has also signaled that a top priority is to address the U.S.-Taiwan balance of trade, currently at a record deficit, in large part because of U.S. imports of Taiwanese semiconductors. U.S. support. Those in Trump's orbit, including Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, have spoken out more forcefully in support of Taiwan. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said in February, despite the administration's America First policy, he is keen to bolster alliances in the Indo-Pacific region, adding, we want to send the signals to China that the area will be and continues to be contested. Treading lightly, experts tell Time it's unlikely even Trump would depart from the delicate status quo the U.S. has facilitated through decades of diplomacy. The policy of one China and strategic ambiguity has served very, very well for decades, says Nicholas Lardy, a non-resident senior fellow at Peterson Institute for International Economics. Others say Trump's appetite for deals leaves open the possibility of an arrangement with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Woolly mice are a first step in restoring the mammoth, by Jeffrey Kluger. This is the science page, and there is a photo. It's not real large, but it's lovely and colored. Two hands swathed in black, probably latex, gloves are holding two mice, and they're fluffy. And they're blonde. Well, they're more tawny than blonde, but they're more blonde than gray, as a mouse would typically be. But they're fluffy. The caption reads, gene-edited woolly mice in the colossal laboratory. Extinction is typically for good. When it comes to the woolly mammoths, however, that rule has now been bent. It's been 4,000 years since the elephant-like beast walked the earth, but part of its DNA now operates inside several litters of mice created by scientists at the Dallas-based Colossal Laboratories and Biosciences. The mice do not have their characteristic short gray-brown coat, but rather long, wavy, woolly hair of the mammoth. They also have the beast's accelerated fat metabolism, which helped it survive the Earth's last ice age. Both traits are the result of gene editing that colossal scientists hope will hasten the reappearance of the mammoth itself as early as 2028. Colossal's been working on restoring the mammoth ever since the company's founding in 2021, the animal's relatively recent extinction, and the fact that it roamed the far north means its DNA has been preserved in multiple remains embedded in permafrost. For its de-extinction project, Colossal collected the genomes of nearly 60 of those recovered mammoths. The mice come in because recreating a species from raw biological material is painstaking. It involves pinpointing the genes responsible for the traits that separate the mammoth from the Asian elephant, its close evolutionary relation. Editing the genome of an elephant embryo and implanting it into the womb of a modern-day female elephant. After 22 months, the typical elephant gestation period, an ice age mammoth should be born into the computer age world, but speed bumps abound. The business of rewriting the genome takes extensive experimentation with hundreds of embryos to ensure the key genes are properly edited. The only way to test if they indeed are is to follow the embryos through gestation and see if a viable mammoth pops out. The nearly 2 years it would take for even a single experimental animal to be born, however, would make that process impractical. What's more, Asian elephants are highly social, highly intelligent, and endangered. Raising ethical obstacles to experimenting on them. Enter the mouse, an animal whose genome is well understood and easy to manipulate, and whose 20-day gestation makes for a quick turnaround from embryo to mouse pup. In the current experiment, researchers identified 7 genes that code for the mammoth's shaggy gold coat and its lipid metabolism. They then rewrote mouse embryos to express those traits. Over the course of 5 rounds of experiments, they produced 38 mouse pups that were gestated and delivered by surrogate mother mice. All of the pups expressed the mammoth traits. There's plenty still to accomplish, however. A mammoth is much more than its fur and its fat, and before one can lumber into the 21st century, the scientists will have to engineer dozens of other genes, including those that regulate its vasculature, its cold-resistant metabolism, the precise distribution of its fat layers around its body. They would then have to test that work in more mouse models, and only if they succeed there, try the same technique on an elephant. Colossal scientists see all of this work as just a first step in developing a more widely applicable de-extinction technology. The company points to studies suggesting that by 2050, up to 50% of the Earth's species could be wiped out, largely because of the changing climate, leading to land degradation, loss of diversity, the rise of invasive species, food insecurity for humanity. Arresting climate change is a critical step, but one policymakers and the public are embracing only slowly. Restoring the species that will vanish, or fortifying the genetic hardiness of those that are endangered to help them adapt to a changing world, is one more insurance policy against environmental decline. The brief news. 2 pages here by Jeffrey Kruger, who wrote the Woolly Mice story. Space, the next view into the cosmos. The giant 40-foot space telescope resting in the airtight, climate-controlled clean room at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, wants nothing to do with the microscopic dust particles clinging to your clothing. So before you enter the room, you stand in a chamber that blows high-powered compressed air at you from head to toe, sweeping you clean. Next, you dress up in surgical scrubs, booties, head covering, mask, blouse, and pants, and pass through a series of doors that take you successively more, that take you into successfully more sterile anterooms. Only then, when your dust can pose no danger to the delicate machine in the center of the room, can you join the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope on the factory floor. There, technicians are busy completing its assembly in preparation for its launch, May 2027, to a spot in space close to 1 million miles from Earth. From there, it may transform our understanding of the cosmos. The vast discovery power of this telescope is going to expand our window of knowledge by orders of magnitude, says Jamie Dunn, the Roman Telescope's project manager. You are going to have a tremendous amount of data available to tens of thousands of scientists. It is just mind-boggling. We will be able to move quickly and map out very large areas of the sky, adds Josh Schleter, the $4 billion telescope's wide-field instrument scientist. We will detect hundreds of millions of galaxies to very high accuracy with very deep imaging. The telescope will be able to look at a patch of sky 100 times larger than both the Hubble Space Telescope and the James Webb Space Telescope can. It will be able to peer up to 13.2 billion light years away, collecting images of the 13.8 billion year old universe when it was just 600 million years old. The 18 detectors in its wide field infrared imaging camera are equipped with 16 million pixels each, providing exquisite image resolution. And its 5.6 feet, 1.7 meter high-gain antenna will be able to send a fire hose of pictures and data back to Earth at unprecedented speed. What is more, all of this data will be open source, available to the world. That gusher will include new observations of exoplanets or planets orbiting other stars, new surveys of the structure of the Milky Way, new studies of dark energy, the mysterious invisible force that causes the universe to expand continuously at an ever-accelerating rate. Roman's findings will be made immediately available to the public, laypeople, and scientists alike, on a universally accessible website. That's because its huge field of view will allow many astronomers and non-astronomers at once to gather data from uncounted regions of the sky with no single principal investigator directing the observation. Every single Roman observation will have huge and broad science return, adds Julie McHenry, Roman senior project scientist. The Roman surveys are defined collaboratively by the science community and collectively owned by the science community. When cosmic objects move toward the viewer, the wavelength of visible light they produce is compressed, like a spring, toward the blue end of the spectrum. Objects moving away emit a light that stretched toward the red end of the spectrum. The universe as a whole is largely red-shifted, since, as the celebrated astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered in 1929, it is forever expanding, with the billions of known galaxies continuously receding from us. The Roman telescope, with its 18 infrared eyes, was designed to study that shift. In 2020, when metal was at last being cut on the new telescope, NASA announced it would be named in honor of Nancy Grace Roman, the agency's first chief astronomer, dubbed the Mother of Hubble. That telescope showed that the rate of the universe's expansion is actually increasing over time, seemingly violating the laws of gravity, which ought to apply a brake on the cosmos' growth. The engine of the accelerating expansion was said to be a still unknown force, dubbed dark energy, which is believed to make up 68% of the universe. The theory of dark energy was first promulgated in 1998, 20 years before Roman's death. The telescope named for her will help unravel the stubborn mystery surrounding it. It will also devote considerable attention to individual stars, specifically focusing on the planets that orbit them. Until now, it has been impossible to spot exoplanets directly, since the glare of their parent star washes out the far fainter pinpoint of the nearby planet, much the way a streetlight would blind you to a moth fluttering next to it. Instead, astronomers infer the presence of a planet, either by measuring the slight dimming of the star when the smaller body passes in front of it, or the slight wobble the planet's gravity causes in the star. The Roman telescope will come at things more straightforwardly, thanks to a coronagraph, an array of flexible, piston-mounted mirrors and optical masks that block the light of the star, allowing the planet to pop into view. These optical elements allow us to beat down all of that noise in the system, says Schleter. Until 1992, astronomers had not discovered any planets beyond the 8 in our own solar system. Since then, they have spotted and confirmed more than 5,500, with thousands of other candidate planets that require more observation and examination. Roman will both be looking for its own newly observed exoplanets. Mission planners predict it could discover hundreds of thousands of them, and possibly be revisiting some of the ones that are already in the catalog. Much of what scientists will be investigating will be the chemistry of the planet's atmospheres, searching for signs of organic activity, especially on small rocky worlds like Earth. Roman will be particularly tuned to pick up the atmospheric wavelength consistent with methane, a molecule closely associated with life, and one that's being studied by NASA's Mars rovers as well. Roman's intended studies of the macrostructure of the universe partly explain why it will be parked in space so far from Earth. In order for the infrared imagers to work, measuring the redshift of galaxies and the expanding cosmos, the telescope has to be shielded from stray heat, since that would wash out a thermal image the same way stray light would ruin an optical one. Roman, like the James Webb Space Telescope, will thus station keep at a spot known as Lagrange Point, one of five spaces in space where the gravity of the Earth and Sun cancel each other out, wouldn't you know? Allowing objects to circle the invisible point as if they were orbiting a solid body like a planet. Roman will also conduct the most detailed survey of the Milky Way that's ever been attempted. Our solar system's region of space lies in the plane of the galaxy. Out in one of its spiral arms, looking toward the galactic center, thus amounts to looking at a vast band of stars, which is what the Milky Way looks like to the naked eye in a very dark sky. Roman will gather images of about 50 billion stars in multiple wavelengths, including the infrared. We're up to half of the stars in the galaxy. The 1 month the survey will take is actually a breakneck pace, 1,000 times faster than Hubble could conduct similar work. Webb's cameras can see deeper into space, about 13.6 billion light years distant, or 13.6 billion years in the past, compared with Roman's 13.2 billion. But Roman's wide field gaze will be much greater. Roman goes wide, Webb goes deep and narrow, says Rob Zillum, deputy project scientist for communications. Roman is context. It's like a fisheye compared to Webb's zoom lens. But like Webb, Roman will be beyond the reach of handyman astronauts. As a result, it has a nominal planned mission of just 5 years, though flight managers do not rule out extending it to 10 years if the machinery holds up and the hydrazine fuel that powers its positioning thrusters lasts. The brief milestones, finally, 2 pages today. 3 articles, one of which is full page. I'll start with reading the thumbnail sketches. They're short, but there are more dides coming up. Scored 50,000 points by basketball player LeBron James across 22 seasons, a threshold never previously reached in the history of the NBA. March 4. Announced the shutdown of Skype. Owner Microsoft said, February 28. In May, the video calling service will be replaced with a free version of Microsoft Teams. That's T-E-A-M-S. Launched Andrew Cuomo's bid for mayor of New York City, March 1. Cuomo resigned as New York governor in 2021 amid sexual harassment allegations. Okay, here are the first 2 dides. Australian plasma donor James Harrison, whose antibodies were used in medication that helped protect more than 2 million babies at age 88, February 17. Died prominent religious historian and former Lutheran pastor Martin E. Marty, who advocated for pluralism in American society at the age of 97, February 25. Okay, moving into 2 pages now of dides. Michelle Trachtenberg, T-R-A-C-H-T-E-N-B-E-R-G, Stealthy Charmer by Zephanie Zakarik. There's a photo here in color of really a lovely woman. She's dressed in a sapphire gown. She has long, dark hair, bright blue-gray eyes, I would say, and she's smiling. When Michelle Trachtenberg suddenly appeared among the already familiar cast members of Josh Whedon's much-loved turn of the 21st century TV show, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, at the start of season 5, no one knew what to make of her. Her character, Dawn, had emerged from nowhere, though the implication was she was the younger teen sister of the show's heroine, Sarah Michelle Gellar's Buffy Summers, and that she had been there all along. Suddenly there she was, eager to be accepted by her older, cooler sister, and that sister's older, cooler friends. She was an interloper. She was annoying. Viewers wanted her to just go away. But Trachtenberg's Dawn was so adorably awkward. So meltingly vulnerable. It wasn't long before the show's fans embraced her. If you were Dawn's age, you related to her. If you were older, you felt protective of her. Trachtenberg, who died February 26 at age 39, was a stealthy charmer. Her presence in early 2000s TV, later she would play the scheming socialite Georgina Sparks on Gossip Girl, exemplifies the hold that even secondary characters can have on us. You don't have to be the star of the show to earn viewers' affection and loyalty, as Trachtenberg did. She started her career doing TV commercials at age 3. At 10, she made her film debut in Harriet the Spy, 1996. Post-Buffy, she played supporting roles in films like Mysterious Skin, 2004, and Cop Out, 2010, though her finest hour in the movie realm may be as the sweet, eager teenager Jenny in the delightfully raunchy teen comedy Eurotrip, 2004. Trachtenberg's Buffy years were the high point of her career, though in retrospect they carry a sting. Several of her fellow actors on the show have in recent years accused Whedon of behaving inappropriately on set. Whedon has denied these allegations. Trachtenberg has said her older co-stars made sure she was always protected, just as the rest of us felt protective of her character. Even so, as a performer, Trachtenberg radiated joy as well as vulnerability. Some Buffy fans grew up with her, while others merely watched her grow up. Either way, those years are a reminder of the gifts actors leave with us, even if in those years of just showing up on set one day after another, they were unaware they were giving us anything at all. Stephanie Zakarik also writes the next column. Died Roberta Flack, R&B luminary, and there's a photo here. It is in color, but it's mostly in browns and golds. It is Roberta Flack with her huge afro. She's smiling with her mouth open at the top of a microphone, singing. She's dressed in brown and gold. No singer defined the silky side of 1970s R&B more than Roberta Flack, who died February 24 at age 88. A graduate of Howard University, she taught in Washington, D.C. public schools before landing an audition with Atlantic Records. Her 1969 debut album, First Take, yielded the 1972 hit that would make her a star. Flack slowed the tempo of The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, written by English folk singer Ewan McCall to a potentially unmanageable tempo, and then, with her assuredly full-bodied voice, held it majestically steady. More hits followed, including another Flack signature, Killing Me Softly with His Song, 1973. Two duets with Donny Hathaway, The Closer I Get to You, 1978, and Where Is the Love, 1972. The latter a breakup number, so filled with life, you desperately hope the song's lovers will find a way. That was Flack's magic. Her conviction shaped every velvety note. Now for the full page. also by Stephanie Zakarik, also died. A photo here in the top corner, left-hand side, black and white, Gene Hackman. Fluffy hair, brushed back, mustache. Everything in shades of gray, so it may be that his hair is gray, or graying. And he's looking dead ahead at the camera. Gene Hackman, every man, leading man. Actors want nothing more than for us to believe in them, but to watch Gene Hackman, who died in February at age 95, almost always meant wrestling with the feeling that no one or nothing could be trusted. He gravitated toward characters whose core of lies came wrapped in the truth, or vice versa. Either way, you had to keep an eye on him every millisecond to detect infinitesimal shifts of feeling, sleight of hand elisions, a sly but peppery sense of humor that could hit you like the kickback on a shot of cheap single malt. His greatness is the kind you measure in molecules, the building blocks of everything. Though he'd had small roles in movies and on television through the early 1960s, Hackman was 36 before anyone really took notice. In Bonnie and Clyde, 1967, he played Buck Barrow, older brother to Warren Beatty's Clyde. The performance was robust and quietly shattering. After that, Hackman worked so steadily through the 1970s, 80s, and 90s that summarizing his credits is nearly impossible. He played a bracingly human man of the cloth in The Poseidon Adventure, 1972, and provided a genius comic cameo as a chaos-inducing blind hermit in Young Frankenstein, 1974. He made a great, dandyish Lex Luthor in several Superman movies and was equally at home in Westerns, winning a Supporting Actor Academy Award for Unforgiven, 1992. Though he retired from acting in 2008, younger audiences may know him for one of his later roles as the hell-raising patriarch in Wes Anderson's The Royal Tenenbaums, 2001, a performance of cantankerous joy. Here was an actor with a marvelous, pliable face, not necessarily movie star handsome, but made up of bits and pieces of star quality. The cleft chin, the ready smile, the slightly doughy nose that somehow made him look comically regal. He was great looking. He was average. He won his first Academy Award for playing dogged New York narcotics detective Jimmy Popeye Doyle in The French Connection, 1971. The movie features one of the most famous car chase sequences in film history. Hackman not just driving, but also being driven by some ferocious, unnameable force is the human element that makes it sing. Yet Hackman's greatest performance is that of the guilt-ridden surveillance expert Harry Call in The Conversation, 1974. No other actor has ever made paranoia so poignant. Near the film's end, Harry tries to get on with the meager pleasures of his life. He unwinds by playing along with jazz records on his tenor sax. But the sounds he spins out cannot dissolve the oral ghosts around him, certain he's being surveilled, just as he has spied on others. He tears through his apartment in search of a bug he never finds. In the final shot, he's playing that horn again amid the lonely wreckage of his apartment. Harry's a man who listens in because joining in is not an option. He is the perennial outsider, and Hackman makes you feel it like a cold, whooshing wind that reaches your bones. That is just one example of the miracle of Gene Hackman. To watch him in any one of his almost insanely varied roles often meant sitting there with your jaw hanging in disbelief. What was he doing? How was he doing it? Why am I buying it? Great actors are also great salespeople. And Hackman was the kind of performer who'd have you metaphorically driving off the lot happily in a Cadillac you could hardly afford. Yes, you bought it, and you would do it again. This is probably the last article from this Time magazine today. It's The Brief Health. I probably will abridge it. It's called Five Ways to Clean Your House Safely by Matt Fuchs. I can hardly believe I'm reading it. While cleanliness is a virtue, germ fixation is not. Cleaning your house too thoroughly or with the wrong kinds of products can be harmful to health. Of particular concern is the overzealous use of potent disinfectants that kill 99% of common bacteria. The pandemic has had a long-term impact, and people use stronger disinfectants now, says Oriane Dumas, a respiratory epidemiologist at the French Institute of Health and Medical Research. Studies reveal the air inside our homes is more polluted than the air outdoors. And a portion of these toxins come from household cleaners. They contain scores of chemicals linked to health problems, including those that affect breathing. The risks depend on the dose, so it's worthwhile to reduce your chemical exposure as much as possible. Here's what researchers know about the risks and how to clean your house effectively while protecting yourself and those around you. I'll read the five topics because I may not be able to read the details of each. 1, use just a few high-quality products. 2, disinfect only when necessary. 3, consider bleach alternatives. 4, go fragrance free. 5, air out your space. 1, to limit your contact with chemicals, select a multipurpose cleaner instead of one for glass, another for bathtub, so on. Reevaluate your product arsenal to find places to cut back, advises Samara Giller, Senior Director of Cleaning Science at the Environmental Working Group. Another easy swap, instead of kitchen cleaner, use soap and water on your counters. Experts recommend cleaners certified as Safer Choice, a label created by U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. 2, disinfect only when necessary. Most of the time, soap and water will work just fine. Soap's really good at grabbing greasy stuff, says Doug Collins, a chemist at Bucknell University who studies cleaning products. For something stronger, he suggests alcohol-based products, ones without added chemicals for killing germs. But unless someone in your house is sick or immunocompromised, you only need to disinfect a few times per month, says Asa Bradman, an environmental health scientist at the University of California, Merced. Focus on high-touch surfaces like faucets and doorknobs. 3, consider bleach alternatives. Bleach can be harmful if used too often or improperly. We recommend hydrogen peroxide because it's effective and pure forms break down into water and oxygen, Bradman says. It's easy to remove from surfaces, while bleach can have an irritating residue. Distilled white vinegar breaks up dirt with less risk than bleach, though it's not as powerful. Whatever you choose, follow precautions and avoid mixing products. Never combine bleach with vinegar, ammonia, or products that have hydrogen peroxide, like toilet bowl cleaners. The resulting chemical reactions release toxic gases. Go fragrance free. We often take satisfaction in cleaners with fresh scents like pine or lemon, a reward for battling the dirt. However, some of the chemicals responsible for these smells are volatile organic compounds, VOCs, which are potentially problematic. Fragrance-free cleaners release fewer VOCs. If you are craving a fresh smell after you tidy, Geller recommends simmering a pot of water with your favorite herbs and spices. People can further reduce their exposure by circulating the air during and immediately after cleaning. Open windows, run fans, keep the HVAC system on. Really get that air circulating to move chemicals out of the space, Geller says. You can protect your skin and airways while you clean with gloves and an N95 mask. Limit use of sprays that contain chemicals called quaternary ammonium compounds. When sprayed, these quats are easily inhaled, may cause irritation and endocrine disruption. Even sprays without quats could harm health if they're breathed in too much, so try spraying into a cloth first, then wiping down surfaces. The last article was not abridged, but we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.